I'm John Kroll. Thank you for joining us today for another illuminating conversation with No Limits. This show, as you know, is for people who care about ideas, events, trends, and people. It cannot work without your participation. That's why we invite you to join the discussion. Please call 866-476-3881. Reach out to us by email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. Today on No Limits, we're going to continue our ongoing community conversation in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media about important public health matters. We're going to talk about immigrant and refugee mental health today on No Limits. If you want to join this important conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can email nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Kizito Kalima, who is founder and executive director of the Peace Center for Forgiveness and Reconciliation, Dr. Adam Parlberg with the Franciscan Health, and Chelsea Davey, who is with Exodus Refugee Immigration. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you here. So first, I'll start with Kizito, I think, and ask, give us an idea of how large a problem this is.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for giving me an opportunity to share our struggle. I'm a refugee myself. I'm a former refugee myself and a genocide survivor from Rwanda. And, of course, I went through all the genocide and, of course, the consequences of a genocide, so which comes with the mental health issues. So it's huge. It's huge because it's a taboo. That's the most important. You know, that's the biggest obstacles of a lot of immigrants because we don't understand what is anxiety, depression, or PTSD in general. We don't know what it is, and sometimes people don't seek help or don't reach out to others because they feel like it's a devil, you know. Mm-hmm. It's always about being possessed. It's about being something, just not mental health issues, known as like medical issues. So it's huge, and being every refugee somehow, somewhere has some kind of mental health issues.
Adam, same question to you. How large a problem is this?
It's an enormous problem. And I think just before we kind of go into it, if you don't mind, just to kind of set the stage and the setting in terms of what is a refugee, because there's a lot of misunderstanding and misinformation as to exactly, you know, what entails a refugee. So a refugee essentially is a person that flees their home based on a well-founded fear of persecution for reasons including things like race and religion, nationality, or membership of a particular group. And again, there's sort of this conflation with immigration and refugees as sort of being similar or being in the same sort of categorization. Refugees, you know, generally do not want to be refugees. They're not refugees by choice. You know, they don't want to leave. They don't even necessarily choose where they get to go, you know, versus immigration, which tends to be more voluntary for opportunity and that sort of thing. And so it's important, I think, to understand that, you know, that, again, these folks are overall, you know, very productive citizens and contributors and very skilled and overall low health risks. They're screened and vetted very heavily, not radicalized. And so the reason I sort of start with this is because it's important. We need to sort of have empathy for those that are most vulnerable. So again, just in the frame of this mental health conversation, I think it's important to kind of set that stage. But again, this is an enormous problem. And generally, the rates of displacement are probably in the 60-70 million range at this point. So it's an enormous problem.
Chelsea, you get the last word.
I get the last word. Well, a lot of the studies that I review about percentages and how large of an issue this are focusing on people who have already moved to America through the refugee program. So Lutheran Community Services came out with a guidebook, and one of the statistics that they give is about one-third of people resettled develop symptoms of depression or PTSD or continue having symptoms of PTSD or depression or anxiety. But this means that two-thirds actually do not. So while a third of people is a lot of people, it also shows that people are incredibly resilient and able to find natural coping skills and supports in the community and their families to help them continue to heal when they've been through so many things. But they say about a third of the people coming in could benefit from formal treatment.
So I'm going to stay with you, Chelsea, but I'm going to give everybody a crack at this one. At the point that Cazito made, I think, at the beginning, how much of there's this reluctance often to acknowledge mental health challenges. How much of this is, you know, we've done a lot of shows in my time out here about mental health in general and the human reluctance to say, I have a mental health challenge, something I have to work on. Are these numbers that we're talking about above and beyond that normal reluctance that speaks to the kind of vulnerability that immigrants and to some degree refugees experience? I'll start with you on that.
Well, I think there are a lot of barriers. I have huge lists of barriers and reasons why it's difficult to seek treatment. But I think beyond the barriers is, like Cazito said, to some degree there aren't words for what mental health concerns are. So you're starting at ground zero to understand yourself, even kind of what's going on and how you're feeling. And then to try to find the words to express yourself and get care is a huge barrier to getting to being helped. So recently I went around the office and asked about the word trauma and the main languages that we serve. So in Arabic, there was a direct translation. Like if I say trauma, an interpreter can say trauma, and we have the same understanding. I asked one of my Burmese colleagues, and he just kind of looked at me like, that's a long explanation. But in the end, it came out to something like a mental injury. In Swahili, there's no word at all. You just lead with the word trauma, and then you explain what you're talking about. But in Kinyarwanda, the word from trauma became more well-known after the genocide.
Yes, yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. So there is a bit more of an understanding, but it still comes out as kind of like the English term is more of like mentally disturbed.
Yes.
So the words even that we're using to describe something as simple as trauma, like when we state that so easily in America, like you're starting at such a level
so
to get people to understand.
There are language barriers and cultural barricades, as it were, to getting an understanding. I guess what I was trying to get at, too, is are the mental health issues different because of the experiences these people have had? I want to get Chelsea's thoughts on that, and then I'm going to go to Adam, and then I because, you know, I gave you the first word last time. I'm going to give you the last word this
okay,
time.
That's okay, fine.
I mean, all right, Chelsea.
If you're discussing, like, symptoms or diagnoses.
Well, and I'm trying to break it down more to get it out of the medical jargon jargon to something that other human beings can understand and empathize with. Yeah,
I think that people are human, and when they are struggling with how they feel, it is very similar to how everyone else struggles when they're feeling with how they feel. So we see a lot of symptoms of depression, of just feeling sad, disconnected, isolated, not having the motivation to go out and do things that we love, or not connecting with the people that we care about. So I think the symptoms are pretty recognizable from when we say mental health in the American culture and when we're talking about the refugee community. I think that it's pretty similar in experience.
Adam, is that a product of the kind of uprooting that you referenced?
Absolutely, yeah. And again, I think the reason these mental health issues are, I think, framed differently is because they're very much informed by trauma. You know, to really understand that, you have to understand that this trauma happens on so many levels. You know, the sort of the framework which we operate from this is, it's obviously very strongly influenced by the migration history, the type of exposure to adversity encountered before, during, and after a refugee's flight. So breaking it down to pre-flight, you know, these sort of events or series of events that kind of cause a refugee to leave their country, whether it's civil war, strife, violence, genocide, that sort of thing. flight is that time between leaving your home and reaching the place that offers some safety. And again, that is also associated with trauma in terms of, you know, these long 100-mile journeys, you know, boat trips that Syrian refugees take. Displacement, that's the next phase where, you know, that's time in a camp, which again is associated with all sorts of, you know, poor living conditions and lack of basic access, you know, to health care and other basic human needs. And then, of course, the main thing we'll talk about today is probably just resettlement, life, you know, post-moving to America. But again, there's trauma at all sorts of levels there, which I think that kind of makes this conversation a little bit different. In terms of the medical side of things, in terms of how healthcare providers can perceive these concerns, the stigma, as we talked about, is a barrier, and also in the sense that, you know, depression, anxiety, and other psychological concerns may be manifested more as sort of somatic complaints. So patients may complain of headaches and dizziness, abdominal pain, diarrhea, that sort of thing. So it makes it more difficult. People are more reluctant to speak very plainly about these things because of the stigmas and taboos of discussing these things. And so it's more manifested somatically in that way.
Well, and Adam, you said we'll probably end up talking more about displacement, but
yeah,
the other things that you were referencing there, it's not like you can separate them out in dealing with the human beings, right? Who are dealing with, I mean, they bring all of that, those experiences with them and the trauma that associated with them when they arrive here. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
And, you know, does that make, are there different courses of treatment or different responses that we have to have to them? Because these are not, by and large, you know, experiences of mainstream Native Americans here.
Absolutely, yeah. And number one, of course, is sort of breaking down those barriers as best we can. You know, we need to establish, you know, an alliance with these patients. You know, we have to allow the patient's story to unfold over many different visits, you know, and understand that, again, there are these cultural sort of barriers, and a lot of these patients, you know, will deal, you know, with these issues in their own ways culturally, traditionally, whether it's traditional medicine or religious, you know, sorts of measures. But again, I think the most important, you know, way to begin breaking down some of these barriers is to really establish that alliance with the patient. And it's going to take some time to allow that to unfold and to allow patients to kind of open up and speak, you know, very, very plainly about these things. And again, with trauma, as I said before, I mean, most of these patients, not most, maybe close to half, have experienced some sort of trauma or maybe even torture. There's a study, I can't quite quote the actual specifics, but it's something along the lines of only like 3% of these patients have told their doctor about some sort of trauma, and doctors, like no doctor had even asked about it. And so, you know, the CDC recommends, you know, at least to begin that conversation, you know, to ask at least two questions. You know, are you a victim of violence in your former country? And then, you know, would you like to describe what happened to you? And again, that doesn't happen on the first visit. It's something, again, that unfolds over time. And so, again, partnering with the patient and sort of establishing that alliance with them is the first step to sort of break down these barriers.
Zito, is it difficult for refugees and immigrants to, you know, feel the sort of trust necessary to talk about their experiences? Because these are painful and in many ways intimate things.
Definitely, yes, yes. That's in order to help them. And I was diagnosed with PTSD when I was in high school, but it's because people realized that I was pretty much being, you know, I was different. Mm-hmm. So, but I didn't know. I didn't know what to say, how to say. There was a language barrier. At the same time, this is the something culturally we're supposed to be reserved. Being reserved in our culture, in African culture, it's being, you know,
it's a virtue.
Yeah, it's a virtue. So talking about your personal issues, it's not respected. So it's hard for any refugee or any immigrant to go there and just share these personal issues. So it took me a while to open up and to seek help, but there was some kind of a physical manifestation. I passed out. I had a headache. I had a migraine headache, constantly migraine headaches, to the point where I almost had a panic attack, and I thought I was having a heart attack. So, and that's where it got to the point where I said, you know what, I need to seek help. And when I was seeking help, I went to the doctor, asking for just headache medicine. And that's what the, you know, the whole conversation started about. Yes, it's very, very, very difficult for a refugee to talk about the mental health issues.
We're talking about mental health challenges faced by many immigrants and refugees today on No Limits as part of our ongoing community conversation in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881, email us at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Kizito Kalima, founder and executive director of the Peace Center for Forgiveness and Reconciliation, Dr. Adam Parlberg with Franciscan Health, and Chelsea Davey with Exodus Refugee Immigration. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today as part of our partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media about ongoing important public health issues or questions. Today we're specifically talking about mental health challenges experienced by refugees and immigrants. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Kizito Kalima, founder, executive director of the Peace Center for Forgiveness and Reconciliation, Dr. Adam Parlberg with Franciscan Health, and Chelsea Davey with Exodus Refugee Immigration. So before we went to the break, Zito, you were talking about your experiences as a high school student and making reference to how you were attempting to deal with the trauma you had experienced and you know, sort of the inherent kind of cultural conflicts, internalized cultural conflicts you went through. Could you talk to us a little bit about what your experience was in Rwanda, what the trauma was? Because I think that's a good way to get us out of making this an abstract conversation and let people understand exactly what it is, how we're affected at a real and personal level.
All right. So thank you so much. So 1994, we had what we called the genocide against Tutsi in Rwanda. So 1.2 million people died within 100 days. And, of course, I was a teenager. I was 15 years old. I was in high school. And my house was attacked. And, you know, I ran away. I got caught. And I was hacked with a machete. And I left in ditch of dead bodies. So when I woke up, I ran away. I got caught. And I was caught again. I ran away. I got shot at. And I ended up living in the swamps for 3 months. So from April to June, from the beginning of April to the end of June, almost 3 months. So that time, when I was rescued, I had to face the reality. I realized I was the only person left in my family. And you know, I didn't know the rest of them. Other people survived. But at that time, I knew my parents were killed. So I have to face the reality being orphaned. I lived in orphanage, group home, refugee camps. And with the injury in my head, the machete in my head, it never get treated because I ran away and I lived in the swamps. I hid in the swamp for this all. So it kind of cured itself the same way that the wild animals self-heal themselves. Mm-hmm. So that how happened. But so I ended up, you know, running away, and luckily I'm 6'9". God bless me the height, and that height provided a means and a way to come to America through basketball. So I came here as a basketball player, but nobody knew exactly the luggages I was carrying. So I had to blend in. I had to be a kid. I had to be cool like everybody else. But my coaches and everybody else can tell that I was not the same kid like everybody else. I was not smiling. I was just too mature for my age, but I was hiding a lot of things. So, because I could not speak the language, I could not even speak English. So anytime I have a headache, anytime I have anxiety, had a migraine headache or nightmares, there's no way I could communicate to people. I remember I used to translate from French to English, and the word I could tell the suffering, the word I could find was paining. And I used to tell the people I used to live with that my head is paining instead of hurting. Yes. Yeah. So, and people would just laugh. you know, because it sounds funny, you know. But I was hurting. I was like hurting. So until I went to college, and it was the same thing. So in college, that's why I passed out. That's why pretty much I passed out when I was driving, and that kind led me to seek help. I tried to do most of the therapy, like everybody else. Mm-hmm. But the thing is about genocide. Being a genocide survivor, it's beyond other therapy. You know, it's no one is prepared for that. You know, no one. I met a lot of my wife is a therapist by herself. She's worked the APY. You know, she's a social worker. She understands exactly the mental health issues. But anytime I talked to her, she said, you know, most of the thing you guys went through, it's beyond our. You know, it's beyond imagination, you know, because you've seen people being killed at the young age. You know, you are left alone, and now you've seen people, your sisters.
And you had to live for 3 months pretty much like an animal
to stay alive. You know, like I have injuries. My toenails were run. You know, when they got treated one like 5 years ago because I had this infection. Just lasted almost 15 years, never got cured. So, and that as a reminder, today, right now, you know, still have nightmares. So I'm able to cope with my anxiety and depression because I realize there's many ways of let it go. But I have to dig deeper and get the point where I'm able to speak and share my stories. But it's not natural. It's not culturally accepted.
Well, and I want, could you talk about what, I mean, are the nightmares recurrent ones, and what do you experience when you're experiencing one of those?
So right now it comes like once a week, but it depends what I watch. If I watch news with the people shooting each other, or you know, Iraqi, Syrians, refugees, anytime I have nightmares and I scream. It's not just I have a nightmare that, you know, it just goes, I scream that my wife wakes me up, my daughters, and now they know exactly what it is. Even my five-year-old daughter, she knows exactly that is having some issues, and it's normal. It's not normal, but she's going to have to get used
to it. It's part of our lives.
It's part of our life. Yeah. She always tap on my back. She said, Dada, it's okay. You know, like last year, 2017, I believe, we came here downtown for July 4th. There was a lot of, you know, fire. And I was driving, and I got so anxious. And my 5-year-old daughter said, Dad, it's a just fire.
Yeah.
So that means she knows it, you know.
Yeah.
But you have to live with it. But the thing is, culturally, it's not accepted to speak about it. I get backlash from my own people that I'm a weak person because I let myself cry. I share my stories. I do a lot of public speaking. I've spoken everywhere. I even spoke at the United Nations. I spoke to life. Because to me, what I realized, there's no cure for PTSD, but it's manageable.
Yeah.
So being manageable, meaning you have to be comfortable with the anxiety. You have to be comfortable with depression. You have to be comfortable with your nightmares. You have to be comfortable with whatever you're suffering from. You have to be comfortable with so you can talk about it. And that's what I chose to do. And it has given me a chance to reach out to other people because it's easier for me to connect with immigrants, like refugees, because I use my story more than anything else. I always tell them that I went through where you went through, maybe worse than you went through, but now I'm able to finish high school, able to get a college education, able to have a house, have a family. I always say that I regained the family I lost dealing with the genocide. I regained the house I lost, and above all, I regained the inner peace. And that's what I always encourage people to do, especially the immigrants, because culturally it's hard to have, especially like women. You know, there are few of the women who's going to say they have been raped during the genocide, during the conflict, which is the number one tool of the perpetrator use, because they know exactly that, you know, that's
it's a great way to break the human spirit.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so, yes. I have to, I realize that, I believe in God, I have my own faith, I believe in, you know, have the way I approach things, but I do believe that I survived for a reason. You know, I didn't survive just for me. I survived for a reason, and it gave me a chance to speak several languages. I've been gone for so long, but I still remember all the languages, almost 4-5 of them.
Yeah.
So, and able to communicate with these immigrants. That's why my office, coming to my office, they come to maybe to apply for driver license, help them to apply for, but I realize there are so much going on in their lives that I encourage them to seek help, you know. And even if those who are able to seek help, sometimes when they take the medicine, because once the first time you take a medicine, sometimes it doesn't work well, and they give up, you know, and they feel like they are being manipulated. So there's a trust issue. So the best way to help refugees or immigrants or other people who are going through what we went through is build that trust. You build that trust by meeting them where they are, you know.
Adam, I want to pull you in now and talk about, you know, in a situation like this, because it does strike me that Casino, you know, when he says that this is beyond at least most Americans' comprehension, you know, in some ways it lived as, you know, how does medicine respond to something like that that seems almost off the scale or off the charts of what human beings should be expected to endure?
Yeah, it's extremely challenging. You know, I mean, you hear refugee accounts, you know, and probably even, you know, with we were just discussing with Casito, you know, these folks seek out counseling and you know, guidance, and the counselor, you know, is experiencing secondary trauma, you know, and sometimes even cries, and that you're supposed to be helping me, you know, in this situation. So it's when you've not had exposure to this sort of, you know, trauma and you know, and have heard these encounters, that makes that very challenging as well. So in addition, you know, in terms of our traditional ways of approaching, you know, trying to break down these barriers, you know, trying to have, you know, culturally minded and of similar ethnicity interpreters as well, to kind of be sort of, you know, cultural brokers as well, you know, to kind of align with the patient as well with you as a physician is really, really important. Again, that doesn't happen, you know, in one visit. That happens over time, you know, and again, as you sort of allow that story to unfold. In terms of medicines, that's the other sort of challenge here as well, you know, in terms of anxiety, depression, PTSD, and whatnot. You know, these things respond fairly well to medicines, in sort of in how we normally see these things in the West. But a lot of our patients are fairly resistant to medicines. Some of these medicines, the SSRI class, Zoloft, Prozac, Lexapro, generally take a good 4 to 6 weeks to take effect, you know, and you know, in terms of having the understanding of that and the patience for that to happen is another sort of challenge there as well. And then obviously just with coping mechanisms in addition to that, there is other non-medical ways that patients have coped. Alcoholism is a big problem and another sort of barrier as well that we have to work through, especially in our sort of Burmese male population. And you know, that generally starts, you know, even pre-arrival. It happened in refugee camps, you know, with boredom and stress and anxiety. And so as a way to sort of cope and escapism, and that sort of continues here in the U.S. after resettlement.
Chelsea, you know, I would think... dealing with stories like these, I mean, there's the sort of medical counseling piece of that, but there's also the work of helping them to, you know, to adapt to what is a new home and a new set of circumstances, which one would think would be difficult enough if, in effect, we were starting at zero. But in many ways, you're starting at a deficit. I mean, there are some wounds that have to be healed. There are things. How does that complicate the work that you have to do?
I think everything has to be individualized. To try to group people as a group of refugees, it won't work. You have to look at each person, their needs, their perspective, their culture, their history, their story, and work with them to begin healing and begin their new life here. So like for Casito's story, when I was looking at it online, I noticed it took 10 years for him to look for formal treatment. 10 years is a long time to look for formal treatment. And even then, the things that he found therapeutic were not always therapy. Therapy had its place, but there were several other things that he did in his life that were therapeutic and helped him heal. The trauma story for some people can be very powerful and a big part of treatment. Normalizing your symptoms, being able to reduce stigma, standing up for your culture and your experiences, and reducing your own symptoms. But some people never want to tell their trauma story. And then we focus on the symptoms. All right, well, what's wrong? What doesn't feel good? How can we work to make those things better? And maybe that will be empowering enough for someone to one day want to tell their trauma story. But this is a lifetime of healing. Mental health is a lifetime of of figuring out what you need and how to ask for it. So it's a very individualized process.
A one-and-done kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we are talking today about the challenges faced by immigrants and refugees in terms of dealing with mental health. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or do what a listener named Dee has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Dee, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I was thinking about my grandparents who immigrated to the United States in the early 20th century. And at that time, there was still so much more that we didn't understand about how the brain functioned, what trauma could do to an individual. And one set of grandparents came from Poland on the Russian border, another from Italy. Thinking about the people from Ireland, these people did not speak English, and yet somehow they helped to build our nation. And I'm just wondering, what do you think it was that helped these people to overcome the difficulties in their life? Maybe they never learned how to speak English, as my Polish grandparents spoke very broken English, but they made sure all of their children spoke English. What did they do? What did these people do in the early 20th century to improve their mental health? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Dee. Adam, I'll throw that one to you.
Yeah, so just, I mean, to maybe sort of clarify, I mean, I guess we're just barely scratching the surface. We're kind of seeing the beginning of these people's stories as well, you know, and you know, these are people that are, you know, contributing, you know, and mm-hmm. you know, enriching our society and are productive and come from places where they are skilled and sometimes are doctors and lawyers and you know, their story is just beginning, you know, and they are inspiring people, and they've shown great resilience and perseverance. So it's hard to say, I guess, at this point. You know, I believe, I mean, they are currently and will continue to be great contributors and builders of this nation and add to the rich diversity and tapestry, you know, of our country. So, you know, I might direct that to Chelsea to kind of, you know, finish that stream up.
Oh, okay, Chelsea.
Well, I am not a historian, and I didn't study mental health when people first were immigrating into the United States. But I do think that the community plays a large role. So we have kind of shifted to much more individualistic society here, and a lot of people had a lot greater ties to their community and community supports that did aid, I feel like, in helping heal related to mental health.
Well, and how much I know Casito has talked about the cultural challenges he faced with his Native culture. I did some research a while back about some ancestors, one of whom was committed to a mental hospital around the time that the D was talking about. And, you know, even the diagnostic tools at that time were so loaded with moral judgment. You know, the categories for this were drunkenness, feeble-mindedness, you know, and they all suggested defects of character. So I think that's what I'd like to talk about when we come back after the break, is, yes, we've talked about the cultural barriers that Casito brought with him. What kinds of cultural barriers do they run into when they get here? What sorts of cultural assumptions do we make that might make the task of recovery more difficult? We are talking about mental health challenges faced by immigrants and refugees here on No Limits today. My guests are Casito Kolima, founder, executive director of the Peace Center for Forgiveness and Reconciliation, Dr. Adam Parlberg with Franciscan Health, and Chelsea Davey with Exodus Refugee Immigration. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 866-476-3881. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about the mental health challenges faced by immigrants and refugees. It's part of our ongoing community conversation in partnership with our colleagues at Side Effects Public Media about important public health matters. My guests are Kizito Kalima, founder, executive director of the Peace Center for Forgiveness and Reconciliation, Dr. Adam Parlberg with Franciscan Health, and Chelsea Davey with Exodus Refugee Immigration. Adam, I'm going to come back to you on that last point I was making right before we went to the break. There still is this legacy, to some degree, a stigma attached to talking about mental health in general. And I referenced, you know, the research where I looked at the diagnostic tools, and this would have been in the late 1920s, early 1930s. And, you know, to acknowledge any one of those things in terms of seeking help was, in effect, to acknowledge before your peers and everyone else that that there was something morally defective or some defect in your character. They were so loaded with judgment. How much of that is a barrier in terms of getting folks who already are in a place where they don't know their surroundings, they don't know so many of the unwritten rules? How much of that stigma that's part of our culture, not the culture they come from, is still a challenge?
Oh, very good question. So you're referring mainly to sort of our country's sort of inherent stigma as well.
Yes.
Okay. I think Chelsea might be a bit more able to address that since this is her expertise. But I feel, as a country, we are continuing to move in the right direction to kind of break down these stigmas and mental health is, sort of a medical condition, akin to diabetes and hypertension, and it's not, a weakness or a character mm-hmm. deficit. Whereas I think some of those barriers are still sort of being broken, on the other side of the sea. But I don't know, Chelsea, what are your thoughts?
Well, I want to make clear also, I was not implying that it is, but I when I was doing that research and I looked that stuff, saw that stuff, I thought, well, goodness gracious, no wonder people didn't go and seek help back in those days. Chelsea?
We have certainly come a long way, but mm-hmm. we have a lot farther to go in reducing stigma and making the treatment of mental health normalized and freeing, as opposed to worrying about what the community is going to say or how you're going to be perceived by your colleagues. I do think culture brings with it different beliefs and different causalities of mental health, which is a different approach a little bit to what the stigmas or different concerns that we would face from people who were from the American culture coming into my office. But I do think that we have made some significant steps in reducing the stigma and in making some of the diagnosis more clear and from a medical perspective as opposed to a moral judgment mm-hmm. As it was originated.
Go ahead, Kizito.
So, I was not born here, but I'm much involved in American culture. My wife is American, and pretty much I live with Americans. So, but what I realized, especially in black community, mental health issues still stigma. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it comes with everything you have to put in a guy's hands, mm-hmm. So what I realized that the stigma comes from American cultures that everything, especially in black community, we always pray. We pray about everything. So that kind of hinders people or even talk about the issues, because once you talk about these issues, people see they tell you that you've been possessed. You need to go to church. You need to find a God. You need to find this and that. Mm-hmm. So but in reality, you are suffering. Because mm-hmm. it's not acceptable. I don't think it's acceptable in every culture. Maybe there's some type of level. Maybe in African culture, it's still a taboo. But still in American culture, what I see, it's not very realistic. Because I do a lot of public speaking, go to schools, and after I speak, the kids come to me. They said, I suffer from this and that. I'm glad you talk about it. We can't say it because my family wants me to go to church, wants me to go to this, which is okay. You know, mm-hmm. God is good. It helps people. It can help. Prayer can help. But you have to be realistic about yourself.
Well, prayer, mm-hmm. honest prayer also has to involve an acknowledgement of what's troubling you.
Definitely.
So,
definitely.
And just articulating that or figuring it out is therapeutic in and of itself.
And that should be included in treatment if that's a source of comfort
Absolutely.
To you.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
But maybe not the only form of treatment if you have severe symptoms.
We are talking about mental health issues faced by immigrants and refugees today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at wfyi. Or do what a listener named Don has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Don, you're on the air.
Wow. Well, thank you very much for taking my call.
Certainly.
Fabulous. Fabulous program. It's very encouraging to hear things like this. There needs to be more dialogue. I kind of wondered what happened to our generation when we were waiting for the changes that love was going to bring and all the civil rights struggles and everything we tried to put into focus. Boy, you've triggered a lot of different things in me. When you were talking about the judgment, I remember years and years ago about the Stanford Binet IQ test, and I don't know who specifically that was given to, but immigrants that weren't acculturated to American norms and mm-hmm. worldview and outlook were basically were considered less than, and in some cases considered retarded and intellectually, I don't know, I hate to use the word inferior, but I think maybe that's what happened. I think, and I hope that a lot of those things have been broken down. And I think this program is kind of emotional for me.
Well, we appreciate.
Yeah, and then with Native Americans now, when you're talking about immigrants and the people that have been displaced so tragically, that brought to mind Native American community and the people that were forcibly removed from their homeland, the five civilized tribes in southeastern United States moved mm-hmm. to the west of Mississippi because Andrew Jackson didn't believe that that white people and Native Americans could coexist. And I don't want to take up too much time. Again, thank you.
Oh, certainly.
For having this program.
Thank you for calling and sharing with us, Don. I really appreciate it. Chelsea?
Yeah. Thank you,
Don.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. So, and we probably ought to say this. It's been implicit, I think, in everything. But trauma, PTSD, are not irrational responses to extreme trauma, extreme injustice, extreme suffering, are they?
No. And again, I'm always surprised at the percentage of people who are not showing symptoms of PTSD after they're sharing their stories with me or their experiences. And PTSD can affect anyone. We all are exposed to trauma, whether mm-hmm. it be through other people or, you know, car accidents or just basic things of life. The amount of trauma that refugee individuals have faced is typically higher and more chronic than the average mm-hmm. population. But I'm always shocked at the resiliency of the human spirit. And even getting treatment for PTSD is, again, showing the resiliency of the human spirit, saying, I want to be better. I want to be whole. I'm not going to let this define me and continue to keep me down.
And I want to pick up a point that Don made, too, about kind of the cultural barriers or assumptions, the things that, I made some reference to kind of the unwritten rules or things that you don't necessarily get on first hearing or understand. As he was saying that, I was remembering a time probably 25 years ago. I was traveling in Taiwan, and in the hotel I was at in Taipei, I'd go up I was an active triathlete at the time, so I'd go up to run on one of the treadmills to get my miles in. And the first morning I went up there, there was, a small Chinese woman walking away on the treadmill next to the one I wanted to. I got there, and I looked at it, and all of the keys were written in Mandarin. I'm a reasonably intelligent man, but I've never studied Mandarin in my life. And I just kind of looked dumbfounded and started punching them at random, trying to figure out, see if one of them would start the thing so that I could do it. And finally, the woman looks over at me and hits the button to get it started, which was helpful. But the look that she gave me at that moment is one I've never forgotten, and I think it's one that probably has many parallels here. It was literally, it said, "Oh, God, he's not just big and clumsy, but he's stupid, too." And you know, I thought, okay, this is what it's like to be. And Cazito, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, yes.
You've experienced that.
Yeah, so that's what we do. That's what we go through every single day. As an immigrant, once you open up your mouth and people hear accent, they feel like you're not educated enough. And most immigrants, all of us, come here to go to school. Trust me. We come here for better life. We know exactly what it is. And we speak more than one language. If you have somebody who have an accent, that means they speak at least two or three languages. And that shows how intelligent we are. But because we don't speak at the same language, with the same accent, that kind of, tell people that we are not educated enough, we are not smart enough. And I have many experiences. I have, personal experience where people would try to judge me. They feel like, I'm just 6'9", a basketball player. But I said, until I start explaining myself, I said, just pay attention, man. I always tell them, pay attention. You have an accent, but you have to pay attention. We speak the same language with our mother, tone. So it is something that a lot of immigrants face, and you have to be confident. I say you have to be super confident, because anytime you say something and somebody say, it just puts you down as an immigrant. So to me, I'm used to that. So anytime somebody say, I say, sir, ma'am, pay attention. Because I'm talking, when you talk, I don't say, I pay attention. Because I know you are speaking the language, which is not my first, my second, my fifth language. That's what so I pay attention. So I encourage people to pay attention when the immigrants are speaking, because they are making sense in their own way. Just be patient. And that's something that I would say, the American culture, we are lacking. We are impatient. Let me just say that. We don't have a patience when it comes to, we want to get things done. Everything has a deadline. So which is, it's okay, it's good. But once you deal with a human being, there's no deadline on the human beings. Because once life is gone, it's gone. That's my biggest, my biggest obstacles that we want to help people, but we put a time limit on how we're going to help them. People are not vehicles. Your car can break down, you take it to a shop, they're going to replace the tire, it's going to run better than it was before. If somebody has a machete in his head, has a bullet in his back, you're not going to remove that bullet and you're expecting him to be normal. You know what I'm saying? It will be something else comes up. So we want people to be patient and make sure that at least you bring them to the level where they're comfortable enough to learn to speak to your level, and make sure that at least we see them as a human being and not as just refugees or immigrants.
And I want to actually get to one last, because I feel like we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the current political climate, too. The fact that there is ratcheted up hostility toward refugees and immigrants in this country, that we had a huge in this state, we had a huge political debate about banning refugees just a few years ago. Chelsea's pretty much chewing through her lip right now. So
as am I.
I'll tell you what, Adam. I'll let Adam, you start on that one, and give Chelsea a time to wipe away the pain for a second.
Yeah, I think just sort of to finish what I had started as well. I mean, again, it's sort of understanding this conflict and understanding definitions. This is about education, and what we're doing right now on the show, I think, is an awesome step towards continuing to educate and inform people about these issues. And again, people don't know the difference between immigrants and between refugees and understand these sort of legal terms, and they're very specific things. But again, refugees are not people, you know, that choose, you know, to come here for opportunity or for betterment, you know, voluntarily. Again, they don't necessarily even get to choose where they go. They don't want to leave their homes, you know. But again, these are not, you know, criminals and rapists and terrorists, you know, as some might want to depict them as, but they are productive citizens. They're people of all sorts of, you know, walks of life and languages, and they bring a diversity of, you know, culture and religion and food, and we are so enriched by it, you know. These people inspire me. They reinvigorate a sense of purpose, and it's so highly rewarding working with these people. But even from a health perspective, overall, these are pretty easy patients. You know, they're overall lower risk. You know, again, they come heavily vetted. This idea that, you know, we need to ban them from coming in until we can know what is going on. We know what's going on, and these patients and these people are highly vetted. You know, they're not radicalized. They're highly educated in many different places, and in many places they are lawyers and physicians, and you know, come from really highly skilled sorts of trades. So, again, they're contributors. They enrich society. You know, and we just need to continue to, you know, to be educated on these matters. You know, and to convey truth here.
And Chelsea, I'm going to give you about 30 seconds because I want to give Gazito a chance to have the last word.
And I think what is most important as a provider is we have to be welcoming. There is a barrier that sometimes people won't come and meet me because they are worried about what I will think of them. Will I understand them? Will I have the appropriate interpreter? But if I can be welcoming and authentic and kind, people would be more willing to share. So I think that goes across the mental health perspective. We're here to serve everyone as mental health providers and social workers. So we have to be welcoming no matter what the larger society is saying, like to do our job well. We are welcoming people, and we're here to listen and look at people as an individual and help meet their need.
Gazito, you do get the last word, but you've only got about 30 seconds to deliver
okay.
it.
Thank you, sir. So,
thank you.
To me, what I always encourage people to do, especially Americans, just, you know, as everybody said, be welcoming. You know, you have to understand this country was built by immigrants. So, you know, so the refugees, most of the refugees, we are forced to come here, but we become Americans, we become citizens. So, patience, being patient with us, just give us a chance to show you exactly who we are instead of putting these barriers because you are adding to our trauma. We are traumatized already. We don't need any other, you know, another fear or another trauma because we have enough. So, but if you give us a chance to welcome us, we will be able to show what we do because most of us here to come here with a sense of safety and want to make sure that we are better off and we build the country.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Gazito Kalima, Adam Parlberg, and Chelsea Davey for what has been an important and provocative conversation. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.